So everyone feeling a little more rested than last night? I was reading your mind. I was able to have that city, that power to read your mind going, when's he going to stop? I'm so tired. Which made a negative imprint in your mind. So this is class two of for classes on the teaching on dependent origination, or you know, I'm tempted to call it translated as just interdependence. But if we do that, then we have to like break away from the idea that these are 12 linear chains, 12 linear links in a chain, because it doesn't work that way. As we'll see, maybe you've already sort of got the idea that, you know, things are kind of flowing in and out, you know, that they're, it's just not linear like that. It has to be in a way, because of language, we have to present it linearly. And so it is, and you can understand it linearly to some extent. But a deeper understanding of this teaching is not linear. It's cyclical. It's a cycle. It's in a circle. And each part informs the other part. Interdependence means everything is in this sort of nexus of interdependence, where one thing and the other thing are influencing each other. And that's how things exist. And they do not exist in any other way than that. So this is a pretty profound teaching on and pretty essential teaching for all forms of Buddhism. This is this and the Four Worthy Truths, the Four Noble Truths, you know, a couple of other sort of teachings. This is, you know, standard issue universal Buddhism, basic Buddhism. And so it's very important if you're, you know, interested in studying Buddhism to understand at least something about dependent co-arising interdependence. So we went through the first three links, four links actually last night, and we'll review those now. And then we'll move on to a couple more links, and then tonight's the not the grand finale, but the most important of the four classes really, because there we really get into like how we could break out of these, out of this chain, you know, chain of pain, right? It's a chain of pain, like Aretha. Chain of pain. So important to know how to break out of it. I mean, you know, it's kind of maybe theoretically interesting to talk about it intellectually, but how, you know, what can I do about it? How can I take this home? So, you know, I just, you know, really want to make sure that we have a practical understanding of this system also. So as extra added attraction, class four tomorrow, is it? Tomorrow afternoon this time, class four, I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. 12's a lot to remember. So five from the Yoga Sutra. The Yoga Sutra presentation is exactly the same, actually. It's exactly the same as this. You know, you use slightly different words and it's reduced. It's more, you know, essentialized, so easier to remember. So don't worry. Don't worry, be happy. That's, I think, the essence of all Buddhist teachings. I saw a cartoon once where it said, if it was the Buddha who came down from Mount Sinai with the tablets, you know, like Moses was supposed to come down with the tablets, if it was the Buddha, and there's big tablets going, you know, don't worry, be happy. That's the whole thing. I think Cindy was mentioning earlier today that it's also important to think about this system as something that goes on, this cycle, that something goes on moment to moment, actually. It's not, you know, there's different presentations of it. You can understand it over the course of a lifetime or three lifetimes. I'll point that out when we get there. But it's also going on moment to moment, you know, that we are reinvigorating the cycle over and over and over again all day long. And so, you know, we can like try to maybe slow down, get it into slow motion a little bit more, and we'll try that, especially tonight. We'll have an exercise on trying to like get at least part of the sequence slow enough so that we can actually watch ourselves doing it. You know, Because we are doing it all the time, but we're not aware of it. It's just kind of happening. No self-consciousness, no mindfulness. You know, this would be a good thing to be mindful of. Everyone wants to be mindful all the time, but, you know, what are you mindful of exactly, you know? And it'd be really good to be mindful of the way that you reproduce your suffering over and over again. That would be a good thing to be mindful of, because then you could, like, recognize what's the problem and insert a solution instead of the problem. There are two weak links in the chain. Two weak links. One of them we've already covered. Ignorance. Ignorance. And Nagarjuna will come back to it at the end, in the final verses of this chapter. He specifically says that, you know, if you want to break this chain, wise up. Wise up about stuff. And one of the things that we can wise up about is dependent origination. You see, one of the understandings of what wisdom consists of is understanding that things do not exist independently, but exist interdependently. And that's a little bit of wisdom. Another sort of very important aspect of wisdom is recognizing that you say your name to yourself is a kind of a phantom. It's an illusion. It's not the you think you are. There is no you the way we think there is. Ordinarily, when we're not being like Buddha heads and, you know, giving the right answers, there's no independent you. Independent, you know, no man or woman is an island. No independent you. No unified you. No one you. You know, and no unchanging you. No you that's in there somewhere that isn't changing along with change. You know, and change is, right? Change is happening all the time. Inner and outer change, all the time. And there's no unchanging part of you. You know, if you don't believe me, go find it. Go back to your cabin and look around in there. And try to find Waldo, you know? You know those games, Waldo? Looking for Waldo, this little dude with the glasses and the scarf. You know, and so try to find, this is the finding Waldo from hell, because it's already hard enough to find Waldo, but there, Waldo is findable eventually in those Waldo things. This is the Waldo from hell. Find Waldo from hell, because he's not there. Waldo ain't home. There's no Waldo. No you the way you think you are. So ignorance means thinking that there's a self when there isn't a self in the way that we think that there's a self. So, you know, and the self puts up a lot of resistance to that, doesn't it? It says, no, I must be in there somewhere. You know, don't listen to him. Soon there'll be dinner. You know, you can maybe go for another swim in the lake. Don't, you know, just wait till it's over. You know, hold your breath and wait till it's over. You know. There's a lot of resistance to the truth. That there isn't a self the way you think that there's a self. And if there were a self like that, the way you think there are, it should be findable. You should be able to say, no, here it is. There, you see. But there's no independent self, no unitary self, no unchanging self, and no master self. No self that's in there calling the shots on everything. I call this the Captain Kirk self. You know, Captain Kirk on his spaceship Enterprise, and he's like sitting up there on the deck in his big commander chair, you know, looking out out that windshield, that awesome windshield that they had, where you just see like stars and cosmos and everything. And then he just sits up there barking orders at everybody, mostly at Scotty, remember? You know, Scotty do this, Scotty do that. Aye, 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 Captain, aye, aye. And we got this notion that there's a little mini-me, a little Captain Kirk mini-me that's in there barking orders, you know, and then arm, raise arm, you know, and then arm responds. Aye, aye, sir, arm responding, arm raising, see. So we, you know, we have a little bit of experience like that. Look, you know, I can command my arm to raise at will. And then we get the idea that, well, that can happen all the time, and everything else is in my will too somehow. You suppose there's a time where Captain Kirk me will say, raise right arm, and right arm will say, no can do, Captain. Right? you can break my arm or have it amputated or get arthritis or die. And then Captain Kirk is all done. You know, the illusion of Captain Kirk isn't that, you know, raised body from dead. No can do, Captain. See? And, you know, we've got this. This is another illusion. And there's so much evidence that proves that there's no Captain Kirk like that. No Captain Kirk like that. Why, for example, if there was a master self, controlling self, would that master ever command you to have a bad day? Why would they ever say, let's wake up today depressed? You know? Why would that ever happen? Why would you ever have any unwanted thing happen to you in life if there was a master self that could just command it away? You know, why would there ever be traffic in Los Angeles? Why would there ever be traffic on the 405? You know, commander self would just go, erase traffic, you know, and then it would somehow happen. And it's our belief that there is a Captain Kirk self like that that causes us a lot of frustration in life. Lots and lots of frustration, right? Just trying to go around changing the present in the present. And it's impossible. Impossible to do. I was recalling recently, you know, these television shows that I used to watch as kids. Some of you are old enough to remember them. Some of you probably have seen them on reruns, because everything's on reruns somewhere, isn't it? No. These were really bad shows from the 1960s, I think. And they were pretty much the same show. There was only slight product differentiation. One was called Bewitched, and one was called I Dream of Jeannie. I think it was in that order too. I think Bewitched was first, and then because of the enormous popularity of this show, Reader's Digest, I did some research on this, Reader's Digest named it one of the top 100 shows of the 20th century. And which is a big statement either about television or Reader's Digest, one or the other. Because it's a really bad show, a really stupid show. The premise of this show was that there's this woman who's a witch. And she's married to this human guy who is like totally inept, and getting himself and their whole family into messes all the time. And she would just fix everything. You know how she did it? She wiggled her nose. She went like that, and there would be sound effects that went accompanied the wiggling of the nose, and then shazam! All of a sudden, everything was fixed. And then because that was such a popular show, they decided to do, you know, sounds familiar, right? They started exactly the same show, only a little bit different. So the next one was I Dream of Jeannie. Dream of Jeannie was also magic. She was a genie. And she also had an inept human husband who always was like getting you know, messed up. And she could change. She called him Master, which was kind of interesting, because she had all the power. You know, but, oh, Master, what would you want me to do now? And, yeah, we'll fix this mess that I made. And she would, instead of wiggling her nose, she had a whole different thing. So that's why it was a whole different show. She would go like that. She would cross her arms like this and then move her ponytail around. And shabam, you know, shazam again. Like, things would just change. So we're going around all day long, going like this all the time, you know, or like this. Hoping that to change the present in the present. Hoping that we our Captain Kirk magical, I Dream of Jeannie, bewitched self that doesn't exist, could change the present in the present. Instead of accepting life, we try to change life. We try to change circumstances. And it's magic. It's just magic. Futile magic. Futile magic. Doesn't work. It would be one thing if it worked. That'd be kind of cool. Then you could just like go around there and, yeah, you know, change this. Better weather, you know, cooler weather, yeah, little rain, you know. It doesn't work like that. So ignorance is the key here. One of the two keys is ignorance, is thinking that things exist that don't. Most importantly, you, in the kind of way that you think of yourself. So your exercise, yes, for class one was to try to like go and find, you know. Go and find Waldo a little bit and realize that we identify with all kinds of stuff. You know, the self is in a perpetual crisis. because it doesn't exist. So it keeps trying to find ways to like pretend that it exists through identification. That's what, you know, that's what it means. Identify with my body sometimes. Identify with different parts of my mind sometimes, you know, and varying times and varying kinds of identifications. Identify with feelings, especially identify with mental afflictions, because then they seem so real. Then I seem so real. You see, when I am angry or I am jealous, you see, then I really get a sense of self, right? Because they're powerful emotions. There's a lot of juice behind a mental affliction. And so the phony self, the fake self, kind of jumps on that bandwagon and hopes that it can be somebody through identification with that kind of energy, with that kind of feeling. So that was part of your exercise. And then the other part of your exercise was to remember that, in a sense, you are nothing but a name. You remember name and form, right? Mental and physical things, name and form. And that's the self that does exist, is a label, is a concept, self-concept. And we all have one. See, that's the self that does exist. And does the concept of the self change or not change? You can talk.
Yes.
Yeah, it changes, doesn't it? Like, automatically, you know, you don't even have to direct the change, and it changes. It will change. So it's a fluid thing too, right? It's a fluid thing, just like any other idea. Ideas change. They're not static. So the other part of your exercise was to learn to take control of the process of the changing self-conception. And that's very possible. This is something you can control. This is something you can direct. Is the way in which we think of ourselves. Why do we think of ourselves the way we do? At any given moment, why do we have the self-conception that we do have? And so I'll spell that out a little bit, and then we'll move ahead. We are who we think we once were. We are now the sum total of who we think we once were. What we think we once did, what we think we once said, what we think we once thought. We are our memories, you could say. Our identity, our self-identity, is comprised of our memories. And if you don't believe me, try a thought experiment. Who would you be without memory? If all of a sudden all your memories were erased, who would you be then? And the answer would be nobody. You would not be somebody. You would not be your little snowflake self, individual self. Our sense of self is comprised of our memories. Yes or no? You know? And that's karma. You could just say that's karma. You don't have to like make it any fancier than that. Karma is memory. Karma is memory. So one of the cool implications of this teaching on the 12 links of dependent origination is that it's also a teaching on how karma works. How karma works. So out of ignorance, which is our base state, we say, do, or think things that leave an imprint, right? That's the second link. Your first link is ignorance, right? You want to look at your pictures? Let's look at pictures. Ignorance, blind person. And then the, out of ignorance, we do say or think things that then make an impression. They make an impression, like the potter making a wheel. It leaves a little fragrance in your mind. Vasana, sometimes they call samskara or vasana. Vasana is sometimes described as, it's like the smell of perfume that lingers in the room after the woman who's wearing it has left. It remains, you know? The deed is done, okay? The deed is done. You do something, the deed is done, but then some imprint, some impression is left. Where? On your mind. On your consciousness, in your memory. You see, a little impression. It's like, sometimes they describe it as an echo. So, you know, an echo starts with something that you say, right? Some action. And then there's a reaction. There's a reverberation later. It's like, sometimes they say, it's like the the imprint that a stamp makes, you know, like you have a stamp that stamps onto like soft clay or something. And the stamp is done, but the imprint remains. So that you carry with you. That's carried with you. One of the big discussions in the history of Buddhist philosophy is, well, how does that happen? You see, where is it carried? Where are these impressions that, you know, of what I did, said, or thought, where are they carried? And, you know, sometimes they have to invent like a whole part, new part of your brain, storehouse consciousness, that to explain how it is that these things are carried on. But actually, they're carried on moment to moment. See, there's no non-changing part of the self. There's no non-changing part of the self. So that's why you can say that you are who you think you once were. And that's a constantly changing thing. Where is memory? You see, where's the past? Let me put it that way. Where's the past? Does the past exist or not exist? Quick. It doesn't exist. It's gone. Okay, past is past. That's why they call it past. But it, of course, does remain where? In your memory. Memory is the only past that exists. And memory is a function of your present mind. Do memories change? Yes or no? Come on. Of course they change. They are ongoing. So your understanding of yourself is a function of who you think you once were. That's kind of important. Who you once were is unknowable. You see, what you actually did or actually said or actually thought is gone. But it lingers on as this kind of samskara, this propensity, as a memory, you see? It lingers on as a memory, and memories are entirely constitutive of your sense of self. So that's how karma works, you could say. Karma isn't something you have. Memories are not something you have. You are your karma. You are your memories. That's all you are. You see? That's why you have the name, nama. That's why you have the label that you do. So if you wanted to change your self-conception, your self-conception is constituted by your memories, by your karma, you could say. And if you wanted to change that, there's two ways to do it, you could say. You can change the memories that you have now. Can you change memories, yes or no? Sort of. You can sort of change memories. I mean, you can't like just say, okay, I was once, an African living in, you know, Zambia or wherever, some African country, see? I was born like that Steve Martin movie. I was born a poor black child, like, you were born who you were. You were born in the family that you're in the country that you were born in, with the language that you were speaking, that you learned as your first language. You know, there's certain data, right? There's data. And you can't just go like pretend like, you know, that you weren't that you somehow weren't what you were. But you can change your interpretation of events. You can change your understanding of the data. And you can change those positively or you can change those negatively. It's change is ongoing. We're constantly molding, like the potter, constantly molding ourselves, our propensities, our samskaras, our memories. And so you can change those positively or negatively. Here's how you change them negatively. Here's how most of us have been dealing with our memories our whole lives. Most memories, many memories. Is to hold grudges. To sit around angry, embittered, you know, hurt about what you think happened. See, what happened is gone. And all the only place it's being carried is in the continually changing present mind as a kind of a vasana, kind of a memory of what you think happened. And most of it is like, you know, many times it's just embittered. It's just angry. It's just upset, sad, you know, whatever it is about what happened to you in the past, what you think happened to you in the past. Can you change that? Of course you can change that. Here's how you change it. Forgive. Unilaterally, preemptively, just let it go. Forgive. And you know, ever heard that before? Ever heard anybody suggest that maybe you'd be happier if you forgave other people and yourself, of course? Yeah? And then gratitude. Feel grateful. Feel grateful for your past, for what you think happened. And then that changes your sense of self right away. Presto, change-o. You don't have to do nothing. You just sit in your cabin and go, I forgive everyone. And you'll, if you really do, it's easy to say, but if you really do, instantly you feel better. Instantly you have a different self, actually. You create a different self for yourself by changing your understanding of your memories. And then secondly, can you change your self-conception over time, in the future? See, that's changing your self-conception vis-a-vis what you think is your past. What about changing your self-conception vis-a-vis the future, or even the present? Can you do that? Of course you can. Of course you can. Start creating different memories. Okay? Everything we do, say, and think now are creating vasanas, creating propensities that we carry with us later. Next week you will be who you think you once were, and that will include this week. Next week you will be, just like you are today, you will be who you think you once were. And that will include this past, this present, which is will be the past. See what I mean? So what kind of person you want to be? You want to be, angry person, nasty person, lying person, stealing person, depressed person. You want to leave those imprints? Or do you want to leave a different kind of set of imprints? And that's how you change yourself. That's how karma works. That's how karma works to improve the self, is by leaving different imprints on your own mind. And that's the only way it works. How else? Nagarjuna is not talking in any one of these links of anything that's happening outside of you. Actually, he's not talking about anything outside of you. He's talking about what's going on inside, and that's what we can change. We can change what goes on inside, and one of the things we can change about what's going on inside is how we relate to what's going on outside. How we relate to events, how we relate to other people, how we relate to the place and time that we're in, how to relate to the here and now. And you can, there's basically two ways to do that, as I said last night, right? You can eternally be saying no. No, I don't want this. No, it shouldn't be like this. Right? Or you can sort of say yes. This is the way it is. It's like this now. Now, it's like this now. These are the cards I've been dealt. Okay? This is the, you're dealt a set of cards in life. That's the second link, in a way. Second link goes into third link, consciousness. We have consciousness. We come into this world with certain propensities. Anyone have any children here? Notice, they got personalities from the very start, right? Where'd they get those from? Well, genetics. Well, what the hell's that mean? How come my kids got certain genetics and other kids got a different genetic? How does that explain anything? You see? It's begging the question to say that they got certain genes and other kids got other genes. Well, why did my kid get, these genes? How come they didn't get Mozart's genes? How come my kid can't write symphonies, concerts at age of 4? And you send him to school. It wasn't like he got a lot of, conservatory training between the age of 0 and 4. Right? They have personalities. People have personalities. So we come into a life like that. That's the cards that we're dealt. We're dealt a certain kind of life overall. We're born, a certain gender. We're born with a certain kind of race, a certain nationality, a certain culture, and a certain time. These things are the cards. And then most of us go through life going, I wish I didn't have these cards. Like, that's going to do any good, Like you're in some one of those card games where you can turn back the cards and say, no, I'd just like a different hand, please. I'd rather be an Ethiopian, or something. Always wanting to be different than who you are, And that's ongoing, see. That's the big hand. The big hand. And you can't change. You just can't just put back your cards. You can't be somebody else. These are the cards you've been dealt. So, you can play them, or you can fold them. That's kind of your options. You can't change them. You can't say, just make me a different person. Give me a different life. You can play your cards, and you can play them wisely, or you can play them crappily, but at least play them, you see? Or you can just fold them and say, the hell with it, you know? And I think the ultimate version of that is suicide. Just like folding your cards and saying, no, I don't want this life. I don't want this kind of life. And then there are versions of suicide up to suicide, you know, of just, you know, denial, just, you know, rejection. So that's also the case on an ongoing basis. On an ongoing basis, every moment we're getting a new hand. Every moment we're getting a hand. Yes, that's experience. That's life. And then you look at your hand and, you know, and say, oh, I don't want this hand. And what good does that do? That's the hand, that's the cards you've been dealt. Can't turn them back. And you can't just change some of them either. You know, like those games where you can put two of them back and keep three? You can't like pick and choose those cards. You can't say, no, I'll take the lifestyle, but I'll get rid of the angry boss. You know, you got the whole hand. And again, there's no... So the question is, how can I play the hand that I've got wisely? I got these propensities. I've got these karmic propensities. And then I get the hand. See, because of the past. You know, the past is bringing us the hand. And in some sense or another, right? And then the question is, how can I play them in the best possible way? See? And so that I'll change my understanding of the player of the hand. See, the hand's out of our control in a way. You know, what kind of hand we get on an ongoing basis is really out of our control. That's what I was talking about last night, right? Of stop trying to micromanage life as if you could make a wave machine so that nothing unexpected would ever happen, so that you would always know what cards you were going to be dealt. And that would be a very boring card game. See. So what you can change is the card player. Can't change the cards. Can't control the cards. But you can change the card player and the understanding of how best to play cards. See. And that's the spiritual life. Spiritual life is learning how to be a card shark. So that no matter what hand you get, you can play it skillfully, right? And also there's no cards up the sleeve either, okay? Like maybe you come to a retreat and go, well, maybe they'll give me a few aces, you know, so that I can just pull them out when I need them. Or a wild card. That would be really good, to have a wild card where I could just say, oh, this is anything. It's not like, got the cards that you're going to get. No, nothing up your sleeve and no turning them back. No trading them in. But how you play them, see, that's crucial. So, we start with ignorance. We start with ignorance, and from ignorance we create these predispositions, these tendencies, these proclivities that stick with us, that stay with us. Then the next is consciousness. Look at Cindy's picture of yours, kind of like Captain Kirk. He's like, only he's a monkey.
Yes.
He is a monkey, Captain Kirk.
Sorry? In the traditional wheel of life, it's a monkey.
It's a monkey because of the monkey mind. See, consciousness is the monkey mind. And then name and form. Cindy's picture has two. I don't know if you noticed in the wheel of life that we gave, a traditional wheel of life, there's three. Three in the boat. Name and form are the obvious, like, two. Name and form, remember, name and form means the mental and physical parts of you. And then sometimes they put a third one in. So we were talking about, like, why? Who's that guy? And where did he come from, that girl? And you could, you know, speculate that the third one would be the sense of self. The sense of self. Based on having a body and having a mind. Because that does determine our sense of self, doesn't it? And again, you can't just change your body and change your mind at will either, you know? Can't just say, oh, I don't want this body. Give me a new body, then I'll be happy. You can change your understanding of your body. That's true. You can change your relative acceptance of your physicality. and the relative acceptance of, you know, what's going on upstairs too, the mind. But you can't just like say, oh, I want a different mind. I want a different personality. I want a different body. I used to teach, some people in this room will remember, when I was teaching in Los Angeles, in my apartment in Venice Beach, one of my students at the time was a woman who was once named one of the most, the top 100 models of the world. She was in the top 100 models of the world. She's an extraordinarily beautiful woman. I mean, you know, like, I don't know if you've seen people like that, men or women, you know, who they just walk into the room and everyone just kind of goes like, whoa, you know, jaw-droppingly, you know, attractive. And she was one of them. And she raised her hand one time in class. Do you remember? She raised her hand one time in class and said, what should one do if they have really like low estimations of their, you know, of their physical beauty? Huh? Negative body image. What should they do if they have a negative body image? And I was like, well, who would that be about? You got like an ugly cousin somewhere or what? She says, no, that's me. One of the top 100 named by, you know, everyone else in the whole world thinks that she's like the one of the most beautiful women in the world. But her own understanding, see, her own understanding of her physicality was very different. So it's not about what kind of body you have. It's about your understanding of your body, of course, right? And so we have the nama rupa. We have the kind of understanding that we do about our bodies and our minds because of the consciousness that carries with it the imprints from the past that are formed by ignorance. So that's how come we have the understanding. It's not that there's something specifically more beautiful about one body than somebody else's body. And it's not like some personality is like better than some other personality. It's our understanding of these things, right? It's our perception. It's all perception. It's all perspectival. So changing the perspective is everything. It's the whole ballgame. So I'll just give you another, and I got to really start the class here, Bruce. I'll just give you another little, you know, kind of tidbit here. This is pretty awesome, okay? This one. You ready? Does anyone in the room have an objective view of life? Anyone here like to put up their hand and say, I have a God's eye view of life that's not just a certain perspective on life? Yeah, you got the God's eye. We all think we have the God's eye view of life, almost always, until we're doing experiments like this, where then we have to, oh, no, I can't say that. All right, so everyone agrees that no one has an objective view of the world. Okay? So that means that everyone has a subjective view of the world. Is that correct? Subjective view. A view that is shaped by your subjectivity. A view that is made possible only by your subjectivity. A subjectivity that's conditioned. Conditioned in all kinds of ways, right? Conditioned by your background, by your upbringing, by your education, by your experiences. You could say conditioned by your karma. Your subjectivity is... Or you could say, if you wanted to be even more accurate, your subjectivity is your karma. It is what we call karma. Okay? So if that's the case... Then we see the world not as it is, but as we are. Is that true or not? Is there anyone who can escape their subjectivity? See, that would be a person who is somehow also able to have an objective view of the world. See? So you have a subjective view. Everyone okay with this? You got a nod or something, you know? Are you okay that you have only a subjective view of the world, that the only knowable world that there is or ever have been or ever will be is a view of the world that is filtered through your subjectivity? Yes or no? So if that's the case, what would happen if you changed your sense of self, which is also another word for subjectivity? What would happen to your perception of the world? Would it change or not? Yes. Of course it would change. It's the only It's the only accessible world there is the world brought to you by your subjectivity. So if you changed your subjectivity, you would change your understanding, your perception of the world, which is the only world knowable to you. The only world that has ever been knowable to you, and the only world that ever will be knowable to you, is a world filtered through your subjectivity. Yes or no? Keep nodding, okay? Because I'm going to get you in a corner here real quick. And then you're going to wish you hadn't nodded so much. So, you know, you could say, all right, change my subjectivity. I am seeing the world not as it is, but as I am. So if I changed my subjectivity, I would change my perception of the world, which is the only knowable world there has ever been. So I might as well just call it the world. If I changed me, I would change the world. And then the jaw should start to drop a little bit. Because then you know, like, what kind of responsibility you have. Not President Obama's responsibility to change the world. Not the Pope's responsibility, not the Dalai Lama's responsibility, not the second coming of some Messiah. It's our responsibility, each and every one of us. If we change ourselves, we change our perspective on the world, which is the only knowable world there has ever been, so you might as well call it the world. It will change the world. Isn't it? Yeah. So now it's your job to do it. Now it's your job to do it. So there's bodhicitta. Now you've got, like, what do you call it? Forced bodhicitta or something like that. Compelled bodhicitta. Painted into a corner bodhicitta. Oh my God, you know. Right? This is awesome. And you can just have to rehearse that syllogism over and over and over again. Because, you know, we follow it along for a while, and then we go, wait a minute, you know, wait a minute. Some trick here, some weird Buddhist, you know, sleight of hand, where all of a sudden I'm responsible for the world. Wait, I didn't sign up for that. But we are. If you go through it, no one has an objective view of life. We all only have a subjective view of life, shaped by our karma, by our propensity. Or you could say it is our karma. The perspective that we have on the world. Who we think we are is a function of who we think we once were. And who we think we are is the filter through which we see the world. Yeah? So if you change who you think you are, you change the filter through which you see the world, which is the only knowable world there has ever been. You might as well just call it the world. Change the world. Change you, change the world. And that's another way in which you can say karma does work. Karma does work. It works to change your perception, which changes your perception of the world. It works to change your perception of yourself. Karma works to change your perception of yourself, which changes your perception of the world, which you might as well call changing the world. But that's the only way it can work. That's the only way. It's not out there. It's not out there working as some law of gravity, you know, external law. It's working on perception. We are who we think we once were, and we will be next week who we think we once were today. And that's how you improve yourself, and that's how you improve the world. And that's the only way. All right, so here we go. Obstructed by ignorance, one creates the threefold karmic predispositions. You know, remember the threefold ones. Our tendency to act, to speak, and to think. The kinds of proclivities we have when it comes to action, speech, and thought. That leads to rebirth. Because of those karmic acts, he or she takes rebirth. Dependent on the karmic predispositions, this is just all review. Dependent on the karmic predispositions, consciousness enters that new rebirth. So he's, you know, the language itself is presenting this as a way of explaining rebirth. And that's one very common understanding of how these 12 links go together, to explain how we go from birth to birth. But every moment is a new birth. Every moment, right? Every moment, every experience in life has the same trajectory. It arises, it lasts for a while, and then it dissipates and dies. Over and over again. Petite mort. Isn't it? Petite mort. Little deaths all the time. Little births, little deaths. All the time. So, you know, don't think, oh, this is just like some This is relevant only to people who believe in rebirth. This is an explanation of how reality unfolds moment to moment. Dependent on the karmic predispositions, consciousness enters that new rebirth. When consciousness is entered, name and form are installed. So then we got body and mind. All right, here we go. Moving on. When name and form are instilled, so this is the two people in the boat in the picture here. Now we're at number four. When name and form are instilled, then number five occurs. The six seats of senses arise. So Cindy's made six little houses there. And she's got a to-let sign out in front of it. I think in America we mostly call it for rent.
Yeah.
So these are six houses that are for rent. Six. The word in Sanskrit is ayatana. Ayatana is a name technically for the six sense organs and the six objects of sense. So, we in the West have five sense organs, and then five correlating objects of those sense organs. So we have visual sense organ, eyeballs, and then we have visual objects. And as I mentioned last night, and I'll hit hard here soon, you can't have one without the other. There can't be a visual sense, sense of seeing, without something that you see. Okay? So the sixth, and then the sixth one is mental. So they regard in India, the ancient India, they regarded the mind, what we would call the mind, as a sense organ. And again, it can only exist as a mind if it's thinking a thought. So just as the sense of the seeing, the seer, the ability to see requires a visible object to be seeing. So the mind, the so-called mind, requires a thought for it to be thinking. So the word the mind is very tricky because it sounds like there's something in there. It sounds like one thing. It sounds like, it sounds like the brain. Sometimes, modern scientists like to equate the brain and the mind, but not all of them, and actually not many as far as I can tell. The neuroscientists still believe in a ghost. There's a ghost in the machine somewhere. Can't explain everything physically in terms of how everything's firing in there and the different lobes and all of whatever they look at in there. So those are the six senses. The six seats of sense arise. The six seats of senses have, when, I should have said something like when, right? When the six senses, six seats of the senses, having come about, oh no, it's okay. The six seats of the senses having come about, contact arises. So I'm not going to go through the commentary here. You can read it yourself. They're basically, one of the ways of understanding this is embryology, is through embryology. So you have name and form. You have like the first sort of possibility for a new being, a new person. And then little by little, as the embryo develops, this is ancient. This is the ancient understanding of embryology. You get more and more and more that makes you a full blown person. So here they're talking about the development of the six sense organs. But as I note in the commentary, one of the many kind of complications of this system is that you must already have had a couple of them before. If you look in the second paragraph, it must be observed that the mental sense power, the mind, and the tactile sense power, the body, must already be there because Nama Rupa is already there. So there must be a mind and a tactile sense power already in subtle forms. So that they are grouped together here as the six senses, six seats of the senses, to indicate that at this point all have arisen. So that's the next link. That's number five, is the five houses, to let, for rent. Because they're empty until what happens? Yeah, some kind of contact. So the next one is contact. They can't really be sense organs unless they're sensing something. Right? So the whole linear presentation is very confusing. And so I hope you are confused. No, I mean, we have to be more creative in our understanding of this than just this happens, this happens. It can't happen that way. There can't be sense organs unless they are sensing something. They aren't sense organs. They can't just sit there going, I have the visual sense organ unless it's seeing something. That's interdependence. So then contact has to come in. Contact comes in next. Contact's represented... Did you put that guy with that arrow in his eye?
No, that's feeling.
Oh, that's feeling. Yeah. Well, contact is the couple getting it on. Right?
Yeah.
Couple in union. Which is a strong form of contact. In any event, while the seats of the senses are necessary for sensation to occur, it is not until contact with the objects of senses that the sense organs are activated and actually sense something. So they're not really sense organs until they sense something. You can't have a visual sense organ without seeing a visual object. And that's what they call contact. Contact occurs between the subject and the object. Okay? So then he goes on a couple more verses here on contact. Contact's very important. He spends like three verses on contact, actually, on how contact occurs. So as a run-up to that, let's think about this a little bit, okay? Can there be contact? All right, let's put it like this. Which comes first? The visual object or the seeing of the visual object? So contact has to be made between the visual object and the seeing of the visual object. Right? So which one comes first? The answer that we will all give, unless we're sitting around going, I wonder what the right answer he wants it should be, is that visual objects are first, isn't it? If we all left the room, all right, if we all left the room, would there still be visual objects in the room? Don't we think that there still would be visual, right? Before we entered the room, were there visual objects in the room? Yeah? So it doesn't depend. For in our ordinary way of thinking, visual objects do not depend on us to be visual objects. That's ignorance. That is impossible. It's like, here's another version of it. Maybe you had this big debate, you know, with your friends one time. If the tree fell in the forest and no one was there to hear it, did it make a sound? And now you know the answer to that question. No. Cannot. Somebody has to hear a sound for it to be a sound. See? Sounds, sights, smells, touches, feelings, tactile things. What am I missing? What's it? Tastes. A taste, that's a good one. How could a taste possibly exist until it was tasted? See, that hamburger tastes good. Requires you to have tasted it. Right? It's not sitting there tasting good by itself. I taste good. How do I know if you taste good until I taste it? Okay? So let's come back. Let's come back to the visual objects. If we all left the room, would there still be visible objects in the room? Of course not. If we all left the room, there would be nobody here to see a visible object. Therefore, it could not be visible. It would not be visible. It would be invisible, because nobody is visibling it. Okay? No, we're walking... This is one of the most fundamental sort of features of our ignorance, is that we're walking around life thinking that things exist in impossible ways. you know, some of us flew into Los Angeles, you know, and we get off the plane and there's LA. You know, it's been there all along just waiting for me to get there, you know. And then I go, and oh, look, LA's here. There, it's like it's been there all along waiting for me to come, and then I come and inhabit it. And for me, that's impossible, actually. It doesn't exist until I perceive it. In Buddhism, these are synonyms. A perceptible thing, a knowable thing, and an existing thing are synonyms. Literally not knowable until, literally not existing until it's knowable, until it's known, right? Literally. So, you know, you can work this out in all kinds of ways. It's important to work this out. Did the new world exist as a new world until Columbus or whoever came, the Vikings or whoever, came over to discover it? Did it exist? For, you know, you have to say for whom, right? Probably existed for the Native Americans. But they didn't call it the new world, they called it, you know, world, where we live, world, right? Did the new world exist for Europeans until and unless it was discovered by Columbus or whoever discovered it? How could it be? In what sense did it exist? Completely unknown, completely unknowable. You say, well, but it existed because it was there. Well, that's what you say now, because you know it's here, right? Post-New World, discovery of New World, but before the New World was discovered, in what sense could you say it existed? For Europeans, huh?
They thought it was India.
When they came, they didn't even know what they came to. They made it into India for a while. Yeah, and then they had Indians running around in India. You see what I mean? It's very deep. It's very deep how ignorant we are. How we constantly go around thinking that things exist in impossible ways. That there could be invisible, visible things. That there could be sounds that we don't hear. See, how are these possible? That there could be tastes that we haven't tasted yet. Sitting there waiting to be tasted as taste, you know, like, it's impossible. This is another way of talking about independent existence rather than interdependent existence. If there was a visible object that didn't depend on a seer seeing the visible object, it would be an independently existing visible object. Independently existing. And if there was a seer who didn't depend on the visible object to be a seer, that would be an independent existing seer. And that's not how reality is. That's an illusion. That's ignorance to think that, you see? Things exist, but they only exist interdependently. And that's the case any which way you cut it, you know. Nagarjuna is great. In other parts of the text, he's sort of like the Muhammad Ali of philosophers. He says, like, you know, I'm the greatest, you know. Nobody can refute what I say. Nobody can refute. If you want to refute me, bring in one independently existing thing. And you guys can do that with me too. I'm just Nagarjuna's representative here. So if you want, in between classes, you can go out and look around the grounds and see if you can find something that exists independently and bring it in, show and tell. Here it is, the one independently existing thing that, you know, that I found. So it's impossible. See, it's impossible to refute. Nothing exists independently. Emptiness itself does not exist independently. Then sometimes, you know, Buddha heads get all like, yeah, but emptiness, ultimate reality, you see. Ultimate reality and deceptive reality are two ways of talking about the same thing. And they need each other. They exist only interdependently. There is no ultimate reality without deceptive reality. There is no emptiness without form. See? No real Buddhist has ever taught that. And then people get sort of like misunderstandings, right? The grasping, the need to find something that isn't just interdependent with something else is very strong. And you know, we do it especially inside. You know, what about me? You know, all by myself here, independent me. But then, you know, well, emptiness is independently existing emptiness. Not like that. Everything exists interdependently, and nothing exists in any other way than that. And that's full stop. Full stop, period. So here's how things exist interdependently. This flow chart here is a, you know, one way of understanding how things exist interdependently. So don't get confused, you know. The flow chart has to flow, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like that. But, you know, I'm trying to point out how if you take the words literally, they don't make any sense, actually. There can't be 6 seats of the senses without them sensing something. So contact then has to occur. You know, and he has to do it sequentially. Has to do it linearly. That's how we think. That's how we talk. We're stuck. We're stuck in language. We're stuck in the way that we have to think, you know, conceptually. But it can't work like that, linearly. So you know, we have to kind of blow up the system even as we're learning the system. We have to recognize that the system isn't systematic. You see? Everything is interdependent. Nothing can exist independently. There can't be an independent number 4 that then leads to an independent number 5. And then number 6. They all have to be in the mix here. All the time in the mix. All right, here comes contact. Form and apprehension of form depend on the I. So he's just taking one example here. He's taking one of the 6 examples. I, nose, tongue, ear, tactile sense, mind. He's just taking your eye. So this is our, you know, this is form. This is part of form, isn't it? Eye. You have an eyeball, right? And the eyeball and apprehension of form, form and apprehension of form depend on the eye. So the eyeball is necessary for you to have, to see something that has form, a visible object. Form means a visible object, right? So you've got eyeball, you've got visible object, and then this word apprehension. This is a technical word in Sanskrit, and it's very difficult to try to find like a good translation of it. I did my best. Other translations include things like attention. Samanvahara. He here notes that once a sense organ has come about, he uses the eye as an example, a sense object, here a visible form, and an awareness or apprehension of that form are made possible. So one way to think about this is that there cannot be seeing or hearing or smelling unless there's 3 things. 3 things have to be. An eyeball, the physical capacity to see, the visible object, which is also form, which is also material, but the consciousness or the apprehension between the two. So you can't actually see with just sensation. That just the sensation on your eyeball of shapes and colors is not seen. They have to be interpreted. Right? It's not physical. Seeing actually is not physical. Hearing and so forth. Of course, they depend on physical things. But the actual hearing or seeing or touching or smelling is actually mental. It's part of a nama, not rupa. And so he fills out what contact entails. He notes that once a sense organ has come about, a sense object and an awareness of that form are made possible. The latter is a sort of technical term for a previous moment of consciousness that can act as the immediate cause for another moment of consciousness. So, I told you it gets technical here. And I don't know that we need to go into all that. The main point is just to realize that any act, any contact between you and your 6 senses and the things that the 6 senses are sensing requires consciousness, requires some kind of interpretation. Something mental has to occur. It cannot happen just physically. So then again, you can go like, well, so which comes first, the eyeball or the form that the eyeball sees or the consciousness between that makes possible the seeing? This is what we call the, you know, for in Buddhism we call this the three spheres, the three spheres of emptiness, right? The emptiness of the subject, the emptiness of the object, and the emptiness of the contact, the relationship between the two. There is no subject. So emptiness means that they do not exist independently. There's no subject, there's no perceiver, there's no seer, there's no hearer, smeller, until and unless there's something perceived, something heard, something seen, okay? So there can be no independently existing subject or perceiver, me. And there can't be an independently existing world out there either. Because the world comes into existence when it is known, when it is perceived, and not until. There's no sense to it. No sense to say that there is an unperceived world. You see? A world that exists but is not perceived. I mean, that's science fiction. You could say, like, you could say all kinds of things in science fiction. But it has no meaning in terms of our actual experience. So the subject depends on the object. I depend on the world. And the world depends on me. You see? The object depends on the subject. The perceived thing depends on a perceiver perceiving it. And that's the emptiness of two of the three spheres. Subject and object. Perceiver and perceived, right? And then there's the link between the two. Then there's the seeing, the perceiving, the present participle. And of course there can't be seeing unless there's a seer and something seen. Right? It's not free-floating perceiving, free-floating seeing, hearing, and all of that, see? So they depend on each other. They interdepend on each other. Those three things, that's the... You can do this with anything, okay? That three is a cookie cutter that you can place anywhere. Anything in experience can be divided into those three things. Subject, object, and interrelation between the two. Okay? Annoyed person. Annoying person. And the annoying between the two. Okay? This is actually part of your exercise, so for class two. Is to think about the emptiness of these three spheres, and not just like as some kind of like party, what is it, trick, you know, where you can impress your friends and neighbors by, oh, look, nothing exists independently, everything exists independently. Press no change, you see, look how clever I am. Is there an annoying person until and unless you're annoyed? Okay? Annoying person's the object. You are the annoyed person, subject. Is there an annoying person without you being annoyed? Impossible. Is there an annoyed person unless there's somebody annoying? You know, we sometimes sort of, you know, think of ourselves and maybe especially others as being just kind of generically annoyed, you know. But they're annoyed at something. You can't just be annoyed all by yourself, right? And there can't be either an annoyed person or an annoying person unless there's that relationship of, you know, linking the two. So how do you get rid of an annoying person? Well, you can try to change them. You can try to change the object. You know, because of interdependence, it means that you change one, you change them all. You change any one of that triad, and you change all three. Okay? And that's the case with all forms of interdependence. There is no present without a past and a future. See, the present has no meaning independently of the past and the future. And there's no future that exists independently, conceptually. No future that exists independently of the present and the past. And there's no, what am I missing? The past that exists independently of a present and a future. These things depend on each other. Like A, B, and C. There's no B without C and A. It's like 1, 2, 3. It's like that Michael Jackson song. 1, 2, 3. It's simple as do, re. There's no do, there's no re, there's no me all by themselves. There's no one without two and three. There's no two without three and one. There's no three without one and two. Everything exists interdependently. There's no annoying person without you being annoyed. And there's no annoyed person without an annoying person. This is a relationship of interdependence. So you can try and change the annoying person. That's kind of how we're usually going about it. And here's how we try to change an annoying person, okay? Yeah. You know, maybe presto change-o, they'll just not stop being an annoying person. And, you know, annoying people, you know, even objectively seem to fluctuate in their annoyingness, don't they? Like sometimes they're more, seem to be more annoying than others. You know, they have a kind of a graph like this, not flat-lined annoying all the time, right? You know, sometimes they're more annoying, sometimes they're less annoying. And over time, an annoying person can stop being annoying altogether. You know, if you wait them out, sometimes they just like, you know, they seem to be different. That can take a long time with an annoying person. That can take much of your lifetime waiting, just kind of waiting for them to stop being annoying. So, but that's one way to stop being annoyed, is to have the perception that the annoying person isn't so annoying anymore, or isn't annoying at all. And then you're not annoyed. Okay? It takes an annoying person for you to be annoyed. So, you know, you could work at that end. You could work on that end. And that's a very important end to kind of try to work at in a certain way. Like, why are you so annoyed by the annoying person? Is there... I got a question the other day in a Q&A that ended one of the retreats I did recently. And it was like, when I go home to my... What was it? Unhappy and... unsupportive husband. This was her entire description of her husband. Unhappy and unsupportive. Like two words to describe his whole being. And, you know, it's like, well, does he have any good qualities? You know, is there anything other than annoying, unhappy, and unsupportive that you could, like, actually focus on? And same with the annoying person. Is there anything other than just being annoying about the person's personality? You know, do they have any good qualities that you could think about? And then you start thinking differently about the annoying person. Or you could work it differently and just start working on not being annoyed. Because if you're not annoyed, they cannot be an annoying person. Right? It depends. They exist dependently as an annoying person on you being annoyed. And that's a lot quicker and easier, actually. It's not easy, I shouldn't. It's not easy, but it's easier than just trying to wait out an annoying person or like, you know, searching your brains for something that isn't annoying about them. You know, when they're a real annoying person, it's really hard to see anything other than annoyingness about them, right? Especially when they're spiked up like that, when, you know, in the graph. So, you know, so then how can I stop being annoyed by the annoying person? If things exist interdependently, they can't be annoying without my consent. Yep. And that's a great sort of empowering thing about interdependence, is that, you know, you can change you. And when you change you, you change your perception of the world. When you change the perceiver, you change the perception. So you can change your perceiver. You can work on not being annoyed. And one way to, so that's part of your own, I'll go through the exercise in a minute. But, that's in our power, you see. That's totally in our power. And one way that you can start, you know, kind of convincing yourself that it would be a better way to live by not being annoyed by, you know, so-called annoying people, of not being upset by, you know, upsetting people, not getting angry about people who are nasty to you, is to think, well, which one's going to be make me happier? Which one would lead to a happier life? By being annoyed my whole life by annoying people? Or to chill out already and to, you know, let it go? To get angry every time somebody says something insulting to me or sends me a nasty email? Or to just say, this is not in my self-interest to get upset. I've wasted enough of this precious life being angry, upset, annoyed, disappointed, sad, you know, because of how I interpret other people's actions. Other people's, you know, words and actions. How I interpret them means I've super overlaid an intention. I've overlaid an intention. On the basis of what they said or did, I overlaid an intention. They were trying to hurt me. They were trying to upset me. They were trying to do this or that to me. But you don't know that, actually, right? You don't know that for sure. Maybe they were trying to teach you. Maybe they were trying to help you stop being so annoyed already about stupid little things. How could you stop? How could you learn patience unless there was an annoying person? See, how could you? Yes, from the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. They are your greatest teacher. They are your only teacher of patience. The only teacher of patience is an irritating person. It's not like somebody who blah, blah, blahs about patience. You should be patient. You should be patient. It's the irritating person that teaches you how to be patient. Without them, you can't learn of patience. See? So that's a different way of thinking about irritating people, isn't it? Annoying people. That's a way of thinking about them, you know. That also is interdependence, right? We depend on them to learn a virtue. Without them, we could not learn a virtue. Is patience a virtue or not? What do you think? Anyone unclear on that? Everyone said, no, I should be more impatient. I'm trying to learn how to be more impatient in life. Patience is a virtue, right? So how could you learn a virtue like that without somebody who's teaching you how to do it? Some annoying person. So instead of saying, well, you're an annoying person, you can say, you are my teacher of patience. And then presto changeo, you just change them. You see? You just change them into something a little more positive. You know, you can do that kind of passive aggressively too. You're my best teacher of patience. You know, you asshole. You know. But at least you're starting to think a little bit different about it. Yeah? A little bit different. Here's another one. Here's another version of that. Is forgiveness a virtue or not? What do you think? Is there anyone here that thinks that people should be less forgiving and more grudge holding? That would be a good way to live, a virtuous way to live? Is there anybody here who knows of an authentic spiritual tradition that teaches that? Don't forgive anybody. You'll be better off that way. So everyone's agreed, right? Pretty much universal. It's a universal virtue. Forgiveness is a universal virtue. How could you forgive unless someone had hurt you? What would there be to forgive? See, you need to have someone who hurt you, who disappointed you, who betrayed you, who, you know, in order to practice forgiveness. Forgiveness is a virtue. They made it possible. And that's interdependence. That's just another application of interdependence. How could you practice virtue? You know, sometimes we get the mistaken idea that forgiveness just means forgetting or something like that. Doesn't mean that at all. It means acknowledging that they did hurt you. You know, whether they meant to or not doesn't matter. Can't know anyway, but they did. They hurt you. They betrayed you. They did whatever it is that you're holding the grudge about. See, you can't practice forgiveness unless you have something to forgive. So very important to get in touch with that. And say, yeah, they really did screw me up. And I'm going to forgive them anyway. Because for me, you see, so that I can practice a virtue like forgiveness, they had to be there to hurt me. And then you move from forgiveness to gratitude. See, how could I practice forgiveness unless they did what they did to me? Thank you. Forgiveness kind of morphs nicely into gratitude, actually. And that's just healthy-mindedness. Then you change the past, like I was talking about before. And on an ongoing basis, you create a better self-image for yourself by being a forgiving person. You know, forgiveness isn't something you just do once or five times or something like that. Ongoing, and so you start to think of yourself as a forgiving person, and that changes your self-image. Having forgave people from the past, that changes your self-image in one way, and being a forgiving person as you go through life changes your self-image in another way. And it's very sort of it's very disappointing to see how much resistance there is in us to doing stuff like that. To doing stuff that's just so obviously in our self-interest. Obviously in the interest of living a happy life. And then this huge resistance comes. I don't care. No. I don't care if it's logical. I don't care, you know, I don't care if it makes sense. I don't care. I don't want to be happy. Some part of us like that. Some part of us is just saying, I don't want to be happy. Because it knows, you know. It knows that this is the way. When you hear this kind of stuff, there's something, the angel in you goes, yeah, yeah, listen even more. Listen closer, you know. Let's do that. And then the devil inside, no. No way. I'm not going to forgive them. They hurt me. Yeah, but no. You know, it's like that. And that's our inner life, actually. That's our inner life when it comes to spirituality. So we got both of them. Everyone's got both of them. No, I don't care if things exist interdependently. I'm not listening to that. I exist. The I is mostly the devil. Mostly the demon in that conversation is when it uses the first person pronoun. Form and apprehension of form depend on the I. Just so does consciousness arise in dependence on name and form. I already did that one. Contact is the conjunction of the three. And from contact arises feeling. So there you have number seven. Feeling is graphically displayed as an arrow in the eye. You could feel that probably, right? That would be feeling. Contact is the consequence of coming together of a sense object, an awareness or consciousness of the sense object, and the sense organ that both depend on. As it occurs before feeling here in this presentation, right? In this sequential linear presentation, it is mere sensation. Mere sensation. But it is a sensation of the quality one perceives in the object of sensation. So, for example, it's a sensation of annoyingness in an annoying person. I have a sensation of them being annoying. It involves the ability to discriminate. So I discriminate between an annoying person and a non-annoying person. It involves that discrimination, one of the five heaps. And then it involves also three different kinds of sensation. The sense object is apprehended as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So even at the level of sensation, pure sensation, discrimination starts to occur at that level too. Something pleasant, something unpleasant, something neutral. When contact occurs, six, seven, feelings are made possible. An agreeable feeling arises from the sensation of contact with what is regarded as pleasant, as a pleasant object. A disagreeable feeling from an unpleasant object, and a feeling of indifference from a neutral object. Okay? So then the next paragraph here just kind of summarizes kind of where we've been, and I think I'll start tonight with that so that we don't have to, you know, clog our heads up with more right now. So let me turn to the exercise. The exercise for class two. And let me repeat that these are meant to be exercises that you do over a week, every day for a week. So doing one in between, you know, classes here on the weekend, won't do you a whole lot of good. It'll do you some good. It'll do you more good than not doing it. So I won't take a show of hands here on how many people spaced out on doing exercise one between last night and now. But try to do it. What else you got to do here besides swim in the lake? You can't swim in the lake all the time, okay? And there's not much else to do here, really. There's no TV and the internet's going off if it hasn't gone off already. So, you know, might as well do it. Might as well try it. Exercise two. Every day for the next week, spend 15 minutes or more reviewing links 5 through 7 in the chain. 5 through 7. So what were they? They were contact, feeling. No, 5 through 7. Six senses, contact, and feeling. Yep. And then especially focusing on the emptiness of the three spheres. That concept is worth meditating on over and over and over again. I think that if you meditated on, for the people who are really into meditation here, if you meditated on the emptiness of the three spheres, you could see emptiness directly. That's a meditation that could bring you to emptiness directly, to see emptiness directly. Because it's the truth. It's reality. This is how things do exist. And, you know, and to kind of figure that out logically is one thing. And to teach it, you know, it's easy, relatively easy. But to realize it deeply, that would change your whole perspective on yourself and the world. You would not be the same person after that. See, the person that you think you are is an independently existing person. And that's an illusion, total illusion. The world that you think that exists is an independently existing world with independently existing things and people in it. And if that illusion was broken down, you would be a very different person living in a very different reality. So it'd be worth thinking, be worth meditating on. So think about it at least. Focus on the emptiness of the three spheres. Once you have the principle of interdependence clear, bring to mind an annoying person in your life, okay? Then you can get to work. And then it's more than just theory. Get in touch with your ignorant sense that the annoying person just is annoying from their own side, independent of your perception of them. Then apply the wisdom. There can be no annoying person until and unless you are annoyed. That is not controversial in any way, okay? Is it? Anyone wish to debate that? Jesus said, love your enemies, you know, right? Didn't he? Love your enemies. It's very interesting. You couldn't actually have enemies if you love them. You couldn't get to the third word if you did the first word. Right? And that's the only way to get rid of enemies, is to love them. Then they cease to be enemies. That's interdependence, right? They can only be, there can only be terrorists if you are terrorized. That's what makes them terrorists, is you're terrorizing, you're being terrorized. If no one was terrorized, they couldn't be terrorists. If you want to eliminate terrorists, stop being terrorized. That's how things work, you see. That's how you get rid of terrorists, is to stop being terrorized. And we're all terrorized. And the results of that are not pretty. Being terrorized, all kinds of stuff has happened as a result of our being terrorized. We bought into it. We allowed them to be terrorists. We made them possible. We make them possible. We make terrorists possible by being terrorized. You can change anything like this, you see? Work the interdependence. So, never mind about terrorists. We can change terrorists later. How about just your annoying person for now? There can be no annoying person until and unless you are annoyed. Resolve to try not to get annoyed by this person any longer, and then see if they can still be an annoying person. See, just give it a go. And it's hard. It's hard not to be annoyed by an annoying person. Right? We're so used to it. We're so habitualized to being annoyed when someone seems to be annoying. And that is not in your self-interest. It is not in the interest of your main goal in life, which is to be happy. The main purpose, the really only important purpose of your life, before it ends, is to be content with life, with your life, to be happy, to be satisfied. And that's not it. Can't be happy and annoyed at the same time. Somebody got to go. So, you know, in the showdown at OK Corral, somebody got to leave town. Annoyed or happy. And guess who's been winning that showdown over and over and over again, whole life? Angry or happy? Disappointed or happy? Holding a grudge or happy? See, which one? Which one do you want? Life is short. Life is running out. How do you want to live the rest of your life? Start now. You got a retreat here. You got training grounds, little laboratory training grounds to start a whole different way of life. Start thinking about life differently. A life that is in your self-interest, a life that you really want to live, that the angel really wants you to live a happy life. So don't let the devil drown her out. All right.